If being more active is a goal this year, WFAE's Charlotte Walks can keep you moving. Commit to run, walk, or hike during our virtual step challenge now through the end of February. Registration and information at WFAE.org. Charlotte Walks is sponsored by Ortho Carolina.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are 9 days to go in the Trump presidency. Even before the events of last week, Democrats, some Republicans, and many others have fretted about how Donald Trump has comported himself while in office, the actions he has taken, and the impact he has had on our norms, traditions, and the institutions of government, the things that have combined to make this a shining example of good government and successful democracy around the world. His approach to the office shocked many, not only because of the actions he was taking, but because many had assumed that because those actions had not been taken by previous presidents, there must have been laws in place to prevent them from happening. Clearly, there were not. Much of what we've thought of as a normal way of doing business depended on people of honor who had respect for the nation and the office being in power. Those norms were defenseless against someone without those qualities. Great harm has been done, both domestically and internationally. So how do we fix it? It's a question we'll be trying to answer for a long time, but perhaps some answers can be found in the book After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. It was written by Jack Goldsmith, professor of law at Harvard University, who has written extensively on presidential power, terrorism, and national security, among other things. Previous to his position at Harvard, he served as assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel and as special counsel in the Department of Defense. And Jack Goldsmith joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You co-wrote this latest book with Bob Bauer, who served as White House counsel to President Obama, who also worked in the George W. Bush administration. And you say it wasn't your original intent to write this book, but in the planning process between the two of you, your conversations kept drifting back to Donald Trump's, quote, perpetual norm-breaking and impatience with legal constraints and their impact on the executive branch. Democrats have long been disturbed by what we've been witnessing over the last 4 years. At least publicly, Republicans have not. So how are average people to know if these concerns are merely partisan?
Well, one way to measure whether the concerns are merely partisan is to measure them against the consensus that prevailed for the 50 years before Trump became president. And in the 50 years since Watergate, there were a whole slew of normative expectations on the presidency, such as tax disclosure, such as avoiding conflicts of interest, such as limits on the abuse of the pardon power, and the like, that presidents, Democrat and Republican, abided by. And that Democrats and Republicans in the Congress and the presidency accepted. So one way to see whether it's partisan or not is to look at the consensus before Trump came into office. Also, there have been some Republicans, and obviously increasingly so, who have been disturbed by some of the president's antics. But you're absolutely right that the politics have led the Republicans to be relatively quiet on these matters.
And how do you explain that? Because if we're basing the abnormal behavior of President Trump against the previous 50 years, in which both Democrats and Republicans had a general consensus on how business and should be conducted and how presidents should operate, why have the Republicans, at least, been so willing and eager to let this happen?
I'm not sure they've been willing and eager. I think that they've done so. Look, we're speaking about a broad swath of people. I think the major explanation is simply politics. They see Trump has he controls his base. He's got a grip on the party. He threatens to make it difficult for anyone who opposes him to win re-election, and people are afraid of that. They think that the energy in the party is in support of Trump, and they've been shy about departing from it because he has threatened retaliation if they do.
So for those who viewed this last 4 years with alarm, they were concerned about norms being trampled, but also about the fact that President Trump's actions revealed that there were few stopping mechanisms in place. We had assumed that there were, as I said, laws in place. Instead, we only had dependencies on honor and respect. Why has it taken 45 presidencies for us to discover this, or for someone to finally cross the line enough for us to notice?
So I would just, I just want to put a marker down. I think that the laws and norms worked a little bit, and maybe we can talk about that later. But you're absolutely right that Trump revealed the extent to which constraints on the presidency were based on norms and not laws. And I think the reason, and that's especially been true, by the way, in the last 50 years when there was a concerted effort after Watergate to instantiate these norms, and which presidents after Watergate complied with the norms in order to further and establish them, because we, those presidents and Democrats and Republicans, thought that they were the right rules for the presidency. Another one that I didn't mention is about Justice Department independence from the White House. The reason it's taken us, so I've been a scholar of the presidency for three decades, and I knew the extent to which norms governed in these areas, but I never realized the extent to which fully that all of the presidents that we've had, Democrat and Republican, fall within a large middle of reasonableness, of honor, of a sense of shame, a sense of decorum. Trump shattered all of these things. And basically, these norms, which aren't enforceable through law enforcement, meant nothing to him. And in fact, it's worse than that, because he seemed to derive political energy from his base from defying these norms. So they've proven, they've actually been somewhat consequential in affecting officials below him, but they've proven useless in constraining Trump, completely useless.
Does that indicate that there's something greater at work here? It's not just the aberration of one man coming into office and just riding roughshod over our norms and traditions, but that there is a zeitgeist in the country, and perhaps it surpasses just presidential politics, where we are becoming more permissive, we are becoming angrier, we are becoming willing to do things to break things in order to fix things.
There's no doubt that this is true. And you see it in Washington and you see it in the country. I mean, Trump came into office on a populist, platform. And, you know, populism is almost by definition anti-elitism. These norms are seen as elitist. These institutions that Trump attacks are seen as having failed the people that voted for him. But more broadly than that, it's not just about Trump and it's not just about the people that supported him. There are other norms in Washington, D.C., independent of the presidency, that have been weakening in a downward spiraling tit for tat of, say, for example, judicial politics. The confirmation process has descended into something that lacks decorum altogether, that's now viewed as pure politics. This goes back 50 years, 30 or 40 years, this has been happening. So it's not just the people who elected Trump, and it's not just Donald Trump. It's happening more broadly in the nation, and it's happening more broadly in Washington.
Everything we do has its foundation, at least politically, in the Constitution. And the Founding Fathers have long been lauded for their wisdom in creating this document that has sustained us for so long, but the same Founding Fathers designed a system with a lot of vulnerabilities in it. Should we rethink our opinion of the Founding Fathers? How could they have done this? Why would they have done it?
You mean allow someone like Trump to become president?
Well, allow him to do the things that he did by not putting prohibitions in the Constitution.
Well, actually, the founders were exquisitely sensitive to the problem of Donald Trump. They worried extensively about a populist demagogue becoming president. And they thought that they dealt with the problem by putting in a whole slew of institutions like the Electoral College, like state legislative control of the Senate, like separated powers. They didn't contemplate parties. They thought that they put in a system that would have made it very hard for a Donald Trump to become elected. Now, our constitutional system has changed a lot since 1789, and it's become a more democratic document, which means it's subject more than it used to be to populist pressures. I mean, and this is, it's not just related to constitutional changes. It's related to changes in how presidents are nominated and elected. That used to be party controlled. It's now done through primary process where the activists have more control. So a lot of things, the framers certainly weren't perfect, but they actually had this problem squarely in mind, and they put in place a system that has actually changed a bit since the 1789. So perhaps they deserve some blame, but I think there's more blame to go around.
Do you think or do you know that other presidents may have taken these liberties with norms and traditions that President Trump has? He just took them in spades all at once, and that made us notice. In other words, could some of these things have been going on all along and we just didn't know, or it was not that big a deal because it was one thing?
I think the latter. So we in the book, we have 14 chapters of concerning different reforms. And we give the history of how those issues operated before Trump. And there are examples where presidents before Trump occasionally violated norms. President Obama weighed in on the Hillary Clinton investigation by the FBI, which was a breach of the norm of Justice Department independence. And there are other examples of occasional norm violations, sometimes accidental, sometimes offhand, sometimes purposeful. The norms didn't work perfectly 100% all of the time, but they worked almost all of the time, and overall they did a terrific job of constraining the presidency, and they were respected. And so the point is not that no one did it before and now Trump does it all the time. The point was that the norm violations were very rare, they were exceptional, and now they're the rule.
There are those who see Donald Trump as a great president, still do. They've been talking about him this weekend, in spite of what happened last Wednesday. And there are those in Congress who, while condemning what happened last week, consider Trump and Trump's role in it, say he was a great president, he did great things. Should whatever great things he accomplished be seen in the light of whatever damage he has done in the process?
Well, I can give you my view, but this is a matter for history to determine. And Trump did accomplish some things. He put some things on the national agenda that weren't on the agenda that are now seen as part of and important parts of the agenda. But there's no doubt, again, I'm not an historian and I'm not writing a history of the Trump presidency, but there's no doubt that whatever he accomplished is going to be tainted, is probably too weak a word, by the way he conducted himself in office, by his attack on institutions, by his attack on democratic norms. Again, he has his supporters. They think that he can do no wrong, and I don't know what to say about that. But I just think that historians, when they're tallying up the balance, it will be impossible to avoid the bad things he did in office. The question is whether people will appreciate at all the things he accomplished.
Yeah. He was able to accomplish the trampling of traditions and norms with a lot of help from his cabinet, from fellow Republicans in and out of Congress who were willing to go along with this. And some say that's because of the cult-like control that he exercised over his fellow politicians. Is it that? Or are we witnessing some sort of a shift in how politicians view our country? Are we witnessing a willing shift toward autocracy and authoritarianism if it increases and perpetuates your own power?
I wouldn't go that far. I do think that, first of all, politicians have always acted self-interestedly to various degrees. And I do think this is a qualitative judgment that we see much more short-termism in terms of thinking, much more self-interest among politicians even than usual. I don't think that we're on the verge of autocracy. I don't think we're on the verge of authoritarianism. We just had a president who relentlessly attacked and tried to stop a peaceful transition of democracy, and the system is still working. And I would also say, just to quibble a little bit with what you said, it's not true that the Republicans always backed him on everything. In fact, at some very important moments, and I'm not lauding the Republican Party, but at some very important moments, they, for example, several times when he was on the verge of firing Mueller, some senior officials in Congress stepped in, and that's one of the things that stop that from happening.
Jack Goldsmith is the Learned Hand Professor of Law at Harvard University and the co-author of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. We'll look at some of the suggested fixes for that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jack Goldsmith's our guest. He co-wrote the book, After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. What has been the worst part, in your view, of this overextension of presidential power? The fact that Donald Trump was able to do what, in fact, he did, and that other presidents could do something similar in the future if brakes are not put on this process in some way, or the fact that Trump overstepped traditional boundaries of power simply for his own political and personal self-interest, which is the worst part of it?
I would say both. let me just combine those points. Trump, more than any other president in American history by a long shot, melded his personal interests to the powers of the office, and he basically used the powers of the office to serve his personal private interests. You saw this when he made money off his businesses. He directed government business to his businesses. You saw this when he tried to use the Justice Department overtly, explicitly, to attack his enemies and to try to protect his friends, much more so even really than Richard Nixon. And in other ways, Trump basically subverted the office for his private ends. And so that was just bad and terrible, and it's just overt corruption, and it's contrary to the way Article 2 should work. The premise of our book is that we can't be sure that we won't see another Trump. And more importantly, and this is an important point, Trump was ineffective and feckless in many ways. I mean, he ignored the norms, but he wasn't as good as he could have been in exploiting them and taking advantage of it. And what we worry about is a much more competent, clever Trump in the future. And that's why we think that now is the time to buck up these norms with laws, to make the norms deeper, and to do everything we can now to try to prevent that from happening later. And it's a good opportunity. Joe Biden is a president who describes himself as a constitutionalist. He will go along with many of these reforms in ways that other presidents might not. So it's a unique time to try to get these things done.
Should it be easier to make these reforms, which in essence weaken presidential power, now that a Democrat is about to go into office and Republicans might be more willing to consider these reforms now that Trump is gone?
Yes, and let me unpack that. So a lot of these reforms, as I said, reflected norms that Republicans agreed with for the last 50 years. And there's no way they would have supported them while Trump's in office. But now that Trump is, if it's possible to make these reforms, it's not necessarily about Trump, but about the presidency. And the person on the receiving end of these reforms is going to be Joe Biden. I do think that there's a possible for bipartisan consensus. But let me just say one more thing. I mean, some of these, you talked about the reforms in terms of weakening the presidency, and in some sense that's true. But it's weakening the presidency in ways that certainly Joe Biden and most presidents wouldn't mind being weakened. It's basically saying no conflict of interests. That's weakening the presidency, but not in a way that anyone besides Trump would disagree with. No, you have to disclose your tax returns. That's not something Joe Biden is going to care about, that constraint on presidential power. So I do think that for the core issues in the book, where there was bipartisan consensus for 50 years, that there is a chance politically for reform here.
Reform, the need for reform was readily apparent prior to the events of last week. The events of last week has put an urgency on doing this. The first order of business, it seems to me, for a Biden administration in order to be successful would have to be getting a handle on the pandemic, getting a handle on the economy, bringing people back to work, et cetera. If he can't do that, he will fail, because in 2 years they'll turn the Congress back over to Republicans. But if you tackle that first, won't the urgency to fix the presidency and to address the problems that led to Donald Trump, and even in the investigation of Donald Trump, won't that lose power and won't it just peter out?
I don't know if it'll peter out, but you're absolutely right that those are going to be and should be the priorities, and there's only so much agenda space and resources in Washington, and that means it's going to be especially difficult to get some of these reforms done. And I also agree with you that if these reforms aren't done in the first 2 years, it's going to be hard to get them done. I think there's basically a two-year window, because after that, everything is about reelection, and I don't think these issues will be on the agenda. I do want to say, though, so I agree with you that this is not the top priority. I do think it's an important priority. And I think, first of all, let me say that some of the reforms, many of the reforms that we propose in the book can be implemented just within the executive branch. And those are perhaps not as hard and fast as statutory reforms, but they're nonetheless important. And on others, there are bills in Congress, there's lots of interest in Congress. The core reforms, I think, could be done with something approaching a bipartisan consensus. The question is whether it can get on the agenda, which is the point you're making. And I don't know the answer to that question.
And whether you can walk and chew gum at the same time, whether you can address both the pandemic and the economy, and address the things that need to be fixed that revealed themselves during the Trump presidency, and also, it seems to me, to go after Donald Trump and his cohorts who helped egg on last week's insurrection. All those things need to be addressed, it seems to me, and I don't know how you do it all. One of the things that we heard repeatedly during the first impeachment process was about the Justice Department memo insisting that a sitting president could not be charged with a crime. Why does a memo from the Justice Department have the power of law? And is that one of the things that must be changed going forward?
Well, let me explain, answer both of those questions. It has the power of law within the executive branch. It's the executive branch interpretation of the Constitution about what can happen to the president. And the reason it is the beginning and end of the story is that it's the Justice Department that would bring a prosecution against the president. So if the Justice Department believes that a sitting president can't be indicted, then the Justice Department is not going to indict the sitting president. It's not binding on courts necessarily, but if the Justice Department's not going to bring the prosecution in the first place, that's the end of the story, and that's why it's been so consequential. I actually think that the opinion is correct. I think it's a hard question. This is not an opinion that was ginned up for Donald Trump. It was an opinion that first was done in the Watergate era. It was examined and reaffirmed during the Clinton administration by an outstanding lawyer named Randy Moss, who's now a federal judge. So this is, and there are reasons, and I'm not saying there aren't arguments on the other side. There are reasons why you don't want to indict and prosecute a president while he's in office. Having said that, the Biden administration can change that. I mean, it's just a Justice Department interpretation. If the next head of the Office of Legal Counsel or the next Attorney General decides that's the wrong rule, they can change it. But that's not going to have any impact on Donald Trump because he, of course, will be out of office and fully subject to prosecution.
Well, let me flip the question around. Should they change it? Because could changing that result in just a tsunami of legal actions against the sitting president every single time a sitting president is in the office?
I don't think that changing the rule and saying that it's permitted for a sitting president to be indicted and prosecuted while in office would lead to a tsunami of charges, because once again, it's the president's Justice Department who has to make the decision to do that. The situation really only arises in a case like a special counsel investigation. This arose because there was a special counsel, Robert Mueller, who was investigating the president, and he bumped up against this rule and was bound by it because it was a Justice Department rule. So it's going to be no matter what happens, whether the rule stays or goes, it's not going to come up a lot. And it will only come up in the context of, as happened in the Trump administration, to be sure, extreme abuse where there's a special counsel.
Donald Trump stressed the importance of everybody being absolutely loyal to him or else. The attorney general was one of those people. The attorney general is not supposed to be working for the president. He works for the United States. How do we make sure that we don't have another Bill Barr who believes that his role is to be the president's personal attorney?
So I don't think that's the role Bill Barr thought he was taking. I mean, Barr, actually, I agree with you completely that Barr took a lot of actions that seemed to be carrying the president's water, and many of them I criticized, and I think he did some things he shouldn't have done. It's also important to realize that Barr rejected a lot of things that Trump wanted him to do. He didn't prosecute Trump's enemies. He didn't publish the Durham investigation before the election. He said that the Roger Stone prosecution was righteous. So again, I'm not defending Bill Barr, but I think even in Barr's case, the important point is even in Barr's case, these norms did some work. I mean, he was mad at Trump when he was tweeting about this stuff, and he said so publicly. But let me say, in answering your question, this is the very hardest thing to do. It's the very hardest thing to reform because Congress can't, there's very little that Congress can do other than at confirmation time and figuring out who the Attorney General is. There's very little that Congress can do to prevent the Attorney General from carrying the president's water. And any norms that get established.
Can't they pass a law that specifically outlines the duties of the Attorney General?
It's very hard to do because of the Constitution. The Constitution gives the President of the United States, and this is clear in Supreme Court precedent, this is why this problem is so hard. The Constitution gives the President of the United States complete control over law enforcement and supervisory control over law enforcement. And the Attorney General is confirmed by Congress, but the President can fire the Attorney General and the President can direct the Attorney General. And absent a constitutional amendment, and maybe in some cases involving a special counsel, absent a constitutional amendment, it's very hard to give the Attorney General the authority to basically disregard the President. That's why we've worked so hard, the country's worked so hard in the last 50 years to set up these norms, which have been consequential. These norms to prevent the White House from intruding upon the independence of the Justice Department. Mm. And there's things that one can do to buck that up. I mean, this is the weakest and hardest. This is the weakest part of the reform program and the hardest.
One of the earlier lies told by Donald Trump was that he was going to release his tax returns as soon as the audit that they were under was finished. If there ever was an audit, it clearly has been finished by now, and yet we still don't have these tax returns. And people have been yelling for this for years. In the last 50 years, as you've said, presidential candidates have released their tax returns, and you are suggesting in your book that we make sure that they make a timely disclosure of their last 10 years of tax returns. We've always taken this for granted. Why is it important in your mind?
It's important, but for a couple of reasons. One, you learn a lot about a president and a president's values and who a president is beholden to, if anyone, by looking at their tax liabilities, where their assets are placed, what their charitable contributions are like. These are all things relevant to an election of a president, and the American people should have access to it. The second reason is it gives a much fuller profile than we otherwise have of the president's business arrangements. And you want to make completely sure that a president in office is acting in the public interest and not acting on the basis of what's going to be good for one of his businesses. And so you've just got to have complete transparency. This is just one part of the reforms on this we would propose. You need to have complete transparency on the president's business. It's basically about preventing overt corruption, making sure the president is doing the people's business and not doing something to enhance his own pockets.
Well, to move it down the line a little bit, you say that laws should bar presidents under the threat of criminal penalty from any role in the oversight of any business, ban presidential blind trusts, and establish procedures for Congress to police the emoluments that presidents would receive from foreign states. Emoluments are gifts and incentives. Has this ever been a problem of any significance prior to Donald Trump?
Not really, no. I mean, we talk about some examples where LBJ's blind trust may not have been quite as blind as he portrayed, but there's been nothing approaching the only word I can think of is the corruption of Donald Trump, which is he established this trust. It wasn't much of a trust. It was completely porous. He's been supervising what's been going on in his businesses. And he's been steering business, and everybody knows that to get access to Trump, you go to his hotel. He's been steering businesses and he's been publicizing his businesses as president. And so there's never been anything close to this. There's never been anything like this. So we basically favor maximum transparency and an effective prohibition on accepting foreign emoluments.
I suppose that a 100% accurate answer to this question would depend on a thorough investigation of Donald Trump and how he's operated while in office. But would it be fair to say that he and his immediate family, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, have actively fleeced the nation for the last 4 years?
It's an interesting question whether they've made more than they've lost, given the terrible reputational hit that Trump's taken. And I don't know what has happened to his businesses as a result of his very controversial actions in office. But there's no doubt that Trump and his family have made money off of the office. Now, whether they've made more money than they've lost, I don't know. But there's no doubt that they've made money off of him being president. And so the answer, at least along that dimension, is yes.
There are many things that he's done that have surprised a lot of people, but there's something in your book that actually surprised me. You say that Congress should expressly bar presidents from, quote, obstructing justice for self-protection, protection of family members, and to interfere in our elections. My God, we have to bar him from that? Aren't they already there? Aren't there already barriers to that?
Well, not really. There are laws against obstruction of justice, of course, but there is a very tricky question about whether and when it applies to the president. And this is what Mueller got hung up on this, and there's a debate, the big debate about the extent to which the current obstruction of justice laws can apply to the president. I won't get into the constitutional technicalities, but one solution to this debate is for Congress to make crystal clear that these general statutes actually apply to the president. And that's what we're proposing. Take away the ambiguity, take away the uncertainty, make it crystal clear that the president of the United States can, in fact, obstruct justice in these circumstances. That would have made Mueller's investigation much easier.
But help me understand this. Obstruction of justice is a crime, end of sentence. Interfering in elections is as well, end of sentence, full stop. So why are there technicalities that might allow some sort of this behavior on the part of the president?
Well, I'll give you an example. Trump fired James Comey in the spring of 2017. Trump did that in the exercise of a clear Article II power. He's allowed to fire the FBI director. The question is, was that an obstruction of justice or was that an exercise of presidential power? Under the current array of laws, and again, I'm being much simpler than the technicalities, under the law as it currently is, it's not clear that the obstruction of justice statute would have applied to the president's constitutional exercise of his power to remove. And so you have to clarify that Congress intends the president to be subject to the obstruction of justice statute, and you have to clarify what the intent standard is. This is all by way of saying that we just need clearer laws to be able to govern the presidency as he obstructs justice.
Jack Goldsmith is our guest. He's the author of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. He is a professor of law at Harvard. We will continue our conversation right after this. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're back with Jack Goldsmith from Harvard Law. He's the co-author, along with Bob Bauer, who worked both in the Obama and George W. Bush administrations, of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. Congress, specifically the Senate, has the power of advice and consent to presidential appointments at the cabinet level. How was Donald Trump able to repeatedly appoint acting heads of departments without ever taking them to the Senate for approval? And is that something that also needs to be addressed?
Yes, this is an area that definitely needs reform. This is also an area where Trump is not the first sinner, but he was the greatest sinner. The reason that Trump is able to put in acting officials who haven't been confirmed by the Senate is that there's a statute that was enacted in the late 1990s that provides for these so-called temporary appointments. And the statute, unfortunately, is very promiscuous and full of loopholes in allowing the president to manipulate who serves in these positions. Prior presidents have done so, especially in the face of sometimes the Senate is recalcitrant and not confirming officials, or obstinate, I should say. But Trump has abused the system much worse than other presidents. And basically, this statute needs to be reformed. It needs the criteria, the circumstances in which a president, especially putting in someone at the head of a department, a cabinet department, have to be narrowed significantly.
How can that? I mean, the Constitution has broad a description of Senate oversight of the president. It says they have the power of advice and consent. It doesn't mean that they can. Doesn't say they can block a person, but they do. So how can a statute change that while it will take a constitutional amendment to change other things?
Well, again, it's an issue-by-issue thing. All the Constitution says is that certain executive officers have to receive the consent of the Senate. And if the Senate doesn't give its consent for whatever reason, then that person cannot be confirmed and cannot be a confirmed official. Since the 1790s, there's always been the problem of what if an office becomes vacant through death or resignation or whatever. And the Senate, remember in the 1790s, they weren't always in session. It took weeks and months for them to get back to Washington. You had to worry about who's going to serve these executive branch roles in the absence of the even possibility of Senate consent. So from the very beginning, from the 1790s, there have been statutes on the books that have allowed for temporary appointments. And it's a very difficult and tricky problem, but it's clearly something, and the Supreme Court has said this, that can be governed by statute. And the problem right now is the current statute we have gives too much power to the president.
Nancy Pelosi intends to introduce articles of impeachment today if Mike Pence, the vice president, doesn't gather the cabinet and exercise the 25th Amendment and take power away from Donald Trump. There is some question about whether that can be done, even if Mike Pence wanted to do it, because we've had several cabinet resignations, and we have a lot of acting heads in the cabinet. Can acting department heads, members of the cabinet, who have not been confirmed by Congress, do they have the power to invoke the 25th Amendment?
So this is an unanswered constitutional puzzle. The experts disagree on this, and this is why one of the reasons why it's fraught. By my estimate right now, we have five actings in the cabinet. And so the 25th Amendment, as you just suggested, says that the vice president and a majority of, it doesn't use the word cabinet, but that's what it means, the majority of the cabinet can certify that the president is unable to conduct his duties. And that will in effect make the vice, and then send that to Congress, and that will affect, at least in the first instance, make the vice president the acting president. The question is, do acting officials count in that? The Constitution doesn't answer that. No statute answers that. Scholars disagree. The prudent thing to do, if Pence is going to do this, is to make sure he has a majority of both the confirmed officials and the confirmed plus the acting officials. That's the way to avoid a constitutional crisis if he can pull it off. Let me also add that the 25th Amendment, while it's available here, is not a perfect fit for this situation. Right. Impeachment is the proper constitutional route, but that's also, given the timing, not a perfect fit either.
Is there any point in doing either of these things, given that there are 9 days left?
I think that there is a lot of point, especially, let me just say, for impeachment. On the 25th Amendment, I think that there's no reason to do that unless we have a serious crisis where Trump is going to be doing something like last Wednesday or much worse. And that would be the situation where we need an emergency action to take away his powers. That's a very, very big and novel step. And I wouldn't recommend using that absent extreme circumstances. Yes, impeachment, though, going back to that vehicle, can serve a purpose. One, it sends a very clear message that what the president did was wrong, and not just wrong, but among the worst things that a president, if not the worst thing, a president of the United States has ever done. His conduct since the election, in his lies, in trying to coerce officials into changing the result, and trying to coerce the vice president to acting unconstitutionally, and then in what he did last Wednesday, all in the service of disrupting a transition of democracy, is the worst thing I think that a president has ever done. And it should be sanctioned through the greatest sanction, that is impeachment. But it's not just that. Impeachment plus a judgment would also, the Constitution allows for the person impeached and judged to be disqualified from future office. And that would be both symbolically important and important in fact, I think.
So aside from that, there are also questions going forward in Washington and other circles following this attempted coup about how to investigate and or prosecute possible crimes that Donald Trump may have committed while in office, in addition to this aiding insurrection. There is a great need for accountability here, but how do you do this without starting a never-ending tradition of political witch hunts by incoming administrations of the previous administration?
It's a great question, and it's a hard question, and it's a question that my co-author and I who come from different political traditions. We were able to agree on everything else in a 440-page book, but not on this. So I'll just say several things. One, if there were ever a president in our history who deserved to be investigated for crimes committed in office, it's clearly Donald Trump. I mean, if he hasn't committed crimes, he's certainly done things that come very close to crimes. And I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Garland Justice Department. Merrick Garland is going to be the Attorney General. The Garland Justice Department to investigate and prosecute the president. My worries are what you just said, and I'll just outline them. One, I think that for a lot of the technical reasons I've been hinting at, it's very hard to prosecute a president because the laws currently aren't aligned the way they should be. Second, for reasons you suggested at the beginning of the show, any investigation and prosecution of Trump is going to take the air out of everything else the Biden administration wants to do. It's going to make it very hard for the Garland Justice Department to restore this idea of ethical independence because it's going to be seen, even if it's not that, as a witch hunt. And at the end of the day, I worry those costs are not worth the benefit. It's also going to keep Trump in the spotlight, which is where he wants to be. And it also, I think, probably will fail, which is the worst possible message you could send, trying to investigate and prosecute and failing. So it's a hard thing to do, but I think that we should try to look forward.
But then there's the other thing. You can't prosecute or indict a sitting president, and there is the norm that you do not go after ex-presidents. So being president has become essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card. You can do anything you damn well please.
That is exactly the counter-argument that my co-author makes. Let me just say, and I accept that argument, and I'm not arguing that we can never prosecute a former president, and I do think that Trump should continue to be investigated and, if appropriate, prosecuted for his pre-presidential actions. There are two investigations going on right now, one in state, one in federal court in New York. And I don't think that there's a norm against prosecuting a prior president. It hasn't come up. But that's definitely the cost. The cost is that it looks like the president who can't be prosecuted while in office should, maybe for prudential reasons, shouldn't be after office. I'm not claiming that as a rule. I don't think it should be a rule. I think presidents can be prosecuted after office for crimes committed in office. But we need to make the crimes clearer than they are now. And I'm simply making a judgment that going after Donald Trump in 2021 is going to be worse for the country than the contrary. And I might be wrong about that, and I think we're going to see if I'm wrong about that, because I think that they are going to go after him.
If you don't go after him for this last incident of egging on insurrectionists, that means that we're going to go after the insurrectionists. We're already making arrests of those people, and we're going to go after them. And Congress people on both sides of the aisle have said they need to have the book thrown at them so that this never happens again. But why throw the book at people who were just doing what they were told by a president who illegally told them to do it?
Well, I'm not so sure that that's an accurate description. I mean, first of all, 100% on board for throwing the book at them. Absolutely, yes. And there's no doubt that Trump, I wouldn't just look at his actions as the Wednesday speech, but I would look at his actions going back to the day after the election, the lies he told, his efforts to disrupt the process. The problem is that those were speech, and it's almost certainly the case that Trump hasn't committed a crime, because the rules about incitement are extremely, extremely speech favorable. And there are all sorts of problems. I just don't think Trump can be prosecuted for that, whether out of office. I think that's an example of a matter where he did terrible things that we wouldn't expect any president to do, but it didn't rise to a crime.
So some say that Donald Trump has made dubious use of the power of the presidential pardon, and there's a question of whether he might pardon himself or his family on the way out. There is a question of whether he might pardon those arrested in last week's insurrection, because he loves them, as he said in his tweet. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution reads, "The president shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment." That's a blanket statement. Has he made dubious use of presidential power, given the way it's phrased in the Constitution?
Yes, he has. Unlike any other president, it's another example. Again, dubious use isn't a good way of putting it. The pardon power, as you say, is among the broadest powers of the presidency, and he's pardoned people. And almost all, if not all, of those pardons are lawful exercises of the pardon power. They're just abusive exercises of the pardon power. Trump has used, like everything else I started off saying at the beginning, he has used the pardon power as a tool of his personal interest. So he's pardoned friends, he's pardoned people he has a connection to, he's pardoned celebrities. He's completely cut out the normal Justice Department process for legitimate pardons. And he's pardoned a bunch of cronies growing out of the Mueller report, maybe to save his own skin. And I think we're going to see more pardons, as you suggest. I think he's going to pardon himself. I fear he's going to pardon the insurrectionists, which he has the authority to do, and it would be effective, and there's nothing we can do about that now.
And is that so is that an argument for the vice president invoking the 25th Amendment?
That is a great and hard question. Should the vice president invoke the 25th Amendment to prevent the president from pardoning the insurrectionists? That wouldn't be a ground, technically, putting my lawyer's hat on, because it would be, the 25th Amendment is about inability to serve in office. It would be a consequence. I mean, one thing that it would mean is if Trump were gone tomorrow or right now, it would mean he couldn't pardon the insurrectionists. And so that would be a consequence of it. It's not what the 25th Amendment was about, but that would be a consequence of it.
Can he pardon himself?
He can, in the sense that he can write out the pardon paper and sign it. Whether it will be effective and whether the Constitution allows it is a completely open question. The scholars disagree across the board. There's no precedent. The Justice Department, however, for 46 years has taken the position that he can't do it. And I think that even though the constitutional argument is very hard and the legal materials are sparse, I don't believe that there are five votes on the Supreme Court to uphold a self-pardon. So he can do it, but if the Biden administration goes after him, I don't think it will work. I don't think it will prevent him from being prosecuted.
Donald Trump frequently called the media the enemy of the people, a phrase right out of an authoritarian playbook. He treated many in the press with the utter disrespect and contempt, and his remarks about the press have led some of his followers to threaten and, in fact, harm reporters and photographers and others in the media. Do you have an opinion on what, if anything, should be done about that in the future?
Yes, this is another hard issue, and we have some proposals in the book. It's very hard to get at this issue because the president has the power to speak. The president has the power to criticize the press. The thing we worry about most is the president using the powers of his office to retaliate against the press, to actually bring legal process or some kind of coercive process against them. So we have proposals in the book to make sure that the president can't do that. That the Inspector General, anytime this happens, will have a shot to look at it and report it to Congress, to try to create a disincentive from allowing a president to use the powers of the office to harm the press. Other presidents obviously have been hard on the press, but none other than arguably than Nixon, like Trump.
The president lied almost every time he opened his mouth. And those lies were supported by his supporters in and out of Congress, particularly within the Republican Party. And there are people still lying about the election within the Congress, even as we speak. Should there not be consequences for anyone in office who or the media, for that matter, who perpetuates demonstrably false, proven lies repeatedly? Should there not be some consequence for that?
What kind of consequence do you have?
I don't know. Being kicked out of office, being ineligible to hold office,
I would be very, very leery about that because politicians tell different shades of lies all the time. We have a First Amendment that gives them the right to speak. It's a despicable thing to do. There are mechanisms to redress it. Unfortunately, our press atmosphere right now is not great at revealing lies and allowing the country to see them. But if you're talking about legal consequences, I think that's a very hard line to police. And I'm not sure it would be consistent with the First Amendment, unfortunately.
Okay. What is the likelihood? I only have 15 seconds. What's the likelihood that Congress will act on any or all of the 50 changes that you suggest in this book?
I think the likelihood is high that they will act on some of them. There's already movement on some, and zero that they will act on all of them.
What's the most important one?
The corruption stuff, conflict of interest, tax disclosure, presidential interference in the Justice Department.
Jack Goldsmith has been our guest. He's the learned Hand Professor of Law at Harvard University, and along with Bob Bauer, the co-author of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. Thank you for the honor.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.